Poet, novelist, essayist, and a wonderful writer of short stories, Sandra Cisneros is my guest on this edition of The Literary Life. She's the author of the acclaimed The House on Mango Street, Carmelo, Woman Hollering Creek, and much, much more. Sandra and I talk about and celebrate the publication of her newest work, the dual language Martita, I Remember You, Martita, Te Recuerdo, called Exquisite by Publishers Weekly, and A Tale Both Beautiful and Brief by Kirkus. In our freewheeling conversation, Sandra treats us to her views on immigration, memory, family, what she's reading, the lure of Paris, and the need for all of us to recognize the humanity in each other and find a way for dialogue to bridge the great divide that seems to have us firmly in its grip.
You know, where do we come to some place with people that we love that we can dialogue and come to some place that we can make meaningful change for both of us? I would like to see that people dialogue with people they love, you know, because it's real easy to shout at people you don't know, but it's very different to listen and dialogue with people that, you know, is your father or your brother or your sister or your child or your mother. I think these are, you know, to me, when I had to come to places where I had to discuss things, for example, I had to write a letter to a woman who wanted to ban House on Mango Street in her community, and she didn't want her child to read it. She'd had a very negative experience, and she just thought her child should not read it. And I remember that my agent at that time, you know, dissuaded me from writing to her. I wanted to write her a letter and dialogue. And Susan said, oh, no, you're just going to waste your time. And I said, you know, I have some time this week. I'm traveling to New Mexico and I was going to write other things. I'm going to write this letter. And I had to imagine I was writing it to my father because he and I were often at odds in my life about everything. And it caused me to write to her with a lot of respect and love. And I think we're not coming to these dialogues with respect and love because it's just an abstract other person, the enemy. But if you think about it being the person you love the most, then you're not going to call them names or bash them or come with a big stick. You can come with respect. And that respect is mutual, you know, the listening and the giving. And I think that's not there in any of our conversations. That's what so has pained me about what's happening with America now. We're not having those dialogues in places of love and respect. So I invested a week writing to this woman and writing her a letter that I rewrote before I sent it, like all week, revising it. And she wrote back to me. And, you know, if you want a more detailed account, it's in my House of My Own book of essays. And she eventually came to some place where I could explain to her the things that she was objecting to that she thought was witchcraft or evil, and her spiritual beliefs was a very different way of what we call brujas in my spiritual beliefs, that are healers and that they have different names in our society in the US that called therapists or nurses or psychologists, you know, that I was just talking about that. I wasn't talking about, and someone's going to put an evil spell on you. And, you know, when we came to some place of dialogue where we could hear each other, and that I said, you know, she had every right to withdraw books from her child's hands as her parent. I can't tell her what to do, but those books need to be there for somebody else because books are medicine. That's not your son's prescription, but somebody else may need that. And we came to some peaceful place. So I think love and respect is missing in the dialogues.
Do you think, you know, as someone who approaches her writing using different forms, do you think it may be the fact that you wrote a letter as opposed to, you know, what happens on Twitter or what happens, you know, in this kind of truncated way that we express ourselves?
Well, the problem is if I had written a tweet or an email, I would have sent it off when I was angry. And it took me a long time to rewrite and rewrite it and rewrite it and rewrite it as if I was going to send it to my father. And my father was no longer alive. So I truly channeled his love. And when I was writing it to some place that was respectful. And I think that that's what's missing is that it's too easy to press send And, you know, everything begins with a thought, and you have to plant that thought to be something that's peaceful and revise and revise and revise. Because a lot of my writing is about revision. People don't see the early drafts where small me comes in and begins with a rant or begins with something evil. And then eventually, you know, through the composting, which is the wonderful, miraculous thing of why we write, that we travel from the small ego eye to this amazing, you know, Buddha-like, God-like person. And, you know, I'm just the rough draft. So when I talk, I make a lot of mistakes and plant a lot of careless Pancho Villa-like seeds, shooting things in the air. And then when I come to the writing and revise, which is me at my highest, that's when I'm best. That's why I chose to write to her.
Today, we're celebrating the publication of your new, most remarkable book, Martita, I Remember You.
And Martita, Te Recuerdo, on the other side, yes. By Liliana Valenzuela, laboring to translate my words into beautiful Spanish.
And it's beautifully done. It's done, for those of you who can't see this, the book has, it's got, it's beveled edges. It's also done, you know, like with flaps, like the old French. You know, the old French.
Yeah, I call it the old Mexican way with the flaps.
The old Mexican way, right. But the old people who published books in paperback. And it's got a beautiful photograph on the cover. And it is bilingual. And for me, who's always struggling with my Spanish, I've had a really good time. I read the English and I'm trying to work my way through the Spanish as well. It's a kind of...
And I had to read the Spanish for the first time and perform it on the audio. So I do the audio in English all the time on all my books, but this is the first time that I did the Liliana's translations. And that was challenging for me just to be
able
to get my lips to work all those words, take a deep breath and enunciate in Spanish. That was difficult.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the origin story of Martita. Where did it come from?
It came from a real Martita that I met, but I like to say there's a series of Martitas. Yes, there was one real Martita that I met in Paris with another woman who was actually Argentine. So there were two Argentine women, but I met two Italian women when I was in Milano, and I met an American woman when I was in Nice, and I met my friend, who's still my friend now, Yasna in Sarajevo, and I met people in Spain. So there was like many Martitas that I gathered together and glommed onto a real Martita. And the real Martita wrote to me when I was back in the States, you know, maybe 10 years later. And a letter came. It's basically her letter, más o menos. And I felt this surge of emotion for her. And I wanted to explore what those emotions were, and trying to follow that story. I wrote the first part of Martita, and I tried to hand it in at that point in my life in the early 90s as a part of the collection of Woman Holler and Creek. But you can see what an odd fish this story is. It's nothing like the stories in Woman Holler and Creek that basically take place in Texas, Mexico. And so my editor said, well, this story obviously doesn't fit and it's not done. It needs to go on further. You can't just stop there. I had stopped at the section of the tango, New Year's Eve tango dance. I stopped there. I thought that was enough. And my editor didn't agree. My agent didn't agree. So I put it aside. And I always loved this story. I just felt it was, you know, I loved how it pulled all of the senses and all the details and the people in it. And then I especially loved when Martita ceased to be me and she would say things that I wouldn't say, and it took off and became other people in my life that I cut and pasted into my own story. So it was born for me traveling when I was 28, 29. But when I was that age, I seemed to attract younger people. I hung out with people in their 20s, men and women. And, you know, very rarely did I meet somebody that was my age or get involved with someone who was older. Mostly all my my companions were young people. Quién sabe? Well, who knows why? And so that's why I could, you know, explore a younger me in the...
Well, what's so interesting is, so you started it when you were the younger you, and then you picked it up again when you were older and you were able to
look. I started it when I was 20. I lived it when I was 28, 29, hanging with a 20-year-old. And I started it like when I was 40 about. Right. And then now I'm 66. So I picked it up when I was 60, some around there, 61.
Yeah, no. So it has, I think that's why it has the certain qualities that it has. It has, you know, I'm 66 as well. And I had that same idea of wanting to go to Paris, and I went, and you know, I had a Ural pass, and I traveled all around in my mid-20s. I had left school at the time, and you know, I lived the kind of movable feast life at the time. I went to all the cafes like you did, and the thing that was so amazing about reading this is that it was so beautifully written. But it had that sense of youth, but it also had that sense of the passage of time. And it had that sense of nostalgia that I, as a 66-year-old, look back at a period of my life where there seemed to be so much hope and so much kind of uncertainty and something that we all kind of reveled in back in that period. And I kept also having this overriding feeling that I had wished that I had run into Martida and her two friends back then. I would
have
loved
it. They were like in every country.
I know, but I didn't end up at those parties. I didn't end up at that tango party. I would have loved to. You know, maybe I was a little too shy. I don't know exactly what it was, but you know, you captured that sense of promise and then looking back, finding the letter thinking of the letter when she's sitting in her kitchen in Chicago and, you know, thinking about a different time. That was added on, wasn't it?
I did the piece when I wrote it, the Chicago part wasn't there. You know, I don't think so, that Chicago part was there. That was added later. When I originally wrote it, it just took place in Paris. And parts of my past floated up. Like, you know, when I was young, I was involved with an anarchist carpenter. he wasn't a real anarchist and, you know, belonged to the International Workers of the World. And
wow.
You know, he owned, yeah, a real one. I have to write about him.
A wobbly, and, you were involved with
a wobbly. Yeah, and I didn't know anything. I was very...
Were you living in Chicago at the time?
Yeah, I was living in Chicago, and he owned a building, and he would often, you know, I'd stay with him in this derelict building that was something like Razzo Rizzio's, you know, foundation, and he'd give me a hammer or a sledgehammer or a scraper and say, come on, help me. And, you know, I was like little Miss Pris. I didn't know how to do anything.
Had you come from Iowa already? You had already.
I had come from Iowa. I was teaching in the barrio. He was one of my colleagues at the community, at the alternative school in the community. And if I stayed with him, it was like a real baptism by fire because it was a hardcore neighborhood. And I lived in a different hardcore neighborhood on the other side of town. So it was, to me, it was scary staying at his house, not only because there were no walls and pigeons flying in, but, you know.
Was he renovating it as well with the idea?
He was rehabbing this dusty old shell of a building and knocking things out and giving me sledgehammers and showing me how to use a sledgehammer, right, how to use a scraper, how to turn. I had no skills about construction, but you know how you see those renovation shows now where the women are like, I got to do that. Not very well and not enough to see the project finished, but he would give me these tools and show me how to use them. I don't know how I thought of that when I wrote this story. I can't even remember how it came up.
So you start the book by saying, most Saturdays you can find me in the dining room with my scraper and blowtorch. Once the kitchen is clean and the girls are at the library. In 88 BC, Mithridates, king of Pontus, on the Euxine.
Was at war with Rome,
Xenophon. Things bubble up from I don't know where inside me, like the sticky layers of varnish I'm attacking with the propane torch. So I was going, wait a minute. How do we get from there to Paris? That's what I'm wondering.
That's a good question.
I was thinking
practice.
I was thinking maybe you're cooking with propane. Maybe you were doing something really unusual with the scraper. It was a very interesting off-kilter way of approaching, which I thought was just brilliant in retrospect when I think back to where it takes you.
We have so many things, Mitch, that have happened to us that we haven't told people. Like, I don't think I'd ever mentioned to anyone that I knew how to use a propane torch and a scraper. And that's one of my little, what I call the 10 times 10, the 10 things that I know that no one else knows. And you have a 10 times 10 times 10, 10 million things. And those are the things that as writers, we need to write about to make the stories come to life.
Well, with your ability with a propane torch, have you ever thought of becoming a sculptress at all?
Oh my goodness. Well, you never know. There's a lot of things in time. I love art. So I never say never anymore because I said I would never live in Mexico. And look.
Exactly.
I'm glad you like that. I just wanted to tell you where that little button came from, you know, from being in my mid-20s with my anarchist boyfriend, who I have to write about in my next book of essays. I want to write about all these exploding cigars, these men in my life who through disastrous relationships and wonderful moments brought me to who I am. And I'm very grateful. Look, I was able to use that. Not only did I learn how to scrape varnish off a hutch, but I got to put it in a story.
Well, exactly. And you've learned how to use all of these good, bad, and indifferent relationships one way or another.
I'm grateful for all the anarchists in my life.
There's hints of your dad in all of this, right?
My father came up in this story before I had written Caramelo. And, you know, he's has a big role in Caramelo, but I've forgotten that he was here. And it's a very accurate autobiographical portrait, you know, that I created.
Well, you even have him as an upholsterer, which is what he was, right?
Yes, yes. Well, I feel so much love for my father and, you know, his profession of sitting there by himself, humming and shouting my mother's name between, you know, hammering the furniture. You know, those are things that I knew so well. And when I wrote the story originally, it was easy for me to write it because I'd witnessed my father and I loved my father and paid attention to his work, his labor. So I was very happy to pay homage to my father and his craft.
Is at one point he asks you in the book to come home, or not you, or the
character. The
come home now. And then you say something like, doesn't he remember how much he traveled? And, you know, and that is autobiographical as well,
that
right?
That is, because when I was in Paris, I understood my father better. My father had meandered during World War II to the United States, got caught up in a war that wasn't his, served and became a U.S. citizen. So I understood my father's vulnerability, the people he talked about who befriended him, the people who saved him when he was in disastrous moments with no money. He told these stories and I understood them because I felt I was repeating my father's life. And it gave me an insight into an immigrant coming to the United States with no resources, no friends. And it has made me very sensitive to the plight of immigrants because I am an immigrant's daughter and I understand my father's life and heard his stories. So maybe, you know, even since House on Mongo Street, I wrote about an immigrant in Geraldo, no last name, and I'm still writing about immigration in this story.
Well, and you write about migration and you write about people on the move. And that was certainly your dad, right? He was, the effect that it had on you going back and forth from Chicago to Mexico. And
even today, you know, every time we go over the railroad tracks, there are people standing outside of town by the railroad tracks holding their IDs from their native countries and asking for coins. And I always, once I understood, because in the beginning, I didn't know who they were, my heart just goes out to the difficult journey that people have going through Mexico, because Mexico is harder maybe than traveling through the United States or as hard. especially with the policies now, it's just the same as, you know, our administration in the US. So it's a difficult time where it's the issue that has been ignored by both parties until now. They can't ignore it. You know, we remember back before 9/11, there was hope for reformation on those immigration laws. And then 9/11 happened and that just got forgotten. So it's been something that is all of the countries, I think, of the first world have not addressed. And they certainly have not addressed it in a proper way by dealing with the sources, but more with the after effects when they come, when people migrate to their country.
Why do you think this country is so reticent at accepting immigrants, even though the entire, you know, most all of us who live here come from an immigrant background in one way or another? Is it about the other? Is it about fear?
I think it's about money, don't you? I mean, I'm not an expert, but I think that it's just easier to shut down a border than to work with other governments in creating some sort of policy and investing in other countries. I think it's just, it's too difficult. I don't think it's too difficult. I think they should get people like Padre Solalinde, who works here in Mexico, giving housing to people who are migrating and giving care, and other compassionate and visionary human beings on the planet. I'm sure there's more than Padre Solalinde. There's human resources that we haven't investigated that, you know, if we can create a Pentagon of warriors, why can't we create a Pentagon of like peacemakers? Well, you know, we're a deeply Christian society in the United States. So how come we don't act like Christ and welcome the stranger? And I think that there's enough people that are good people in all parties, in all parts of the United States, who want to do the right thing, but I think we lack leadership. And I'm saying, you know, leadership that is not coming from one party to another, but leadership that can bring people, great spiritual leadership that can bring us all together to communicate with respect and love.
That is very so beautifully said. Shifting a little bit, you know, we all have Martitas in our life. We all remember them. It's such a universal story.
And I wonder if the real Martita, maybe I could find her, because I don't remember her, you know, this was before the internet. I don't know her last name. I don't know where she is. I hope she reads this story and realize that I've taken parts of her and like a piece of sculpture, I've sculpted on. Here it is, without my little blowtorch, I've sculpted on the lives of many of my Martitas in my life to create a Martita that's based on her, but that isn't her.
Well, and the other beautiful thing about the story is that it was a melding of so many different cultures too. You know, you have, you know, one of the three women is from Italy, another is from Argentina. You were in Chicago.
I just met these women. As I said, they felt like they came from the Republic of Women. There was a lot in common with all of us, regardless whether we spoke Italian or Serbo-Croatian or Spanish. And I just put them all together in my stories because they are lodged in my heart. I write them from my heart and I edit later from my head. So a lot of things just sprouted here without my even being conscious of what I was doing.
How long were you in Paris at the time?
I was actually in Paris just like 5-6 weeks. It was very short.
But it has quite an impact, doesn't it? Why Paris? Why does Paris have that impact, do you think?
Well, you were there too. Why? Because it's some sort of a confirmation and baptism for us as writers. You know, we want to get to the Mecca of where writers go to write, maybe to convince ourselves that we're really artists. Yeah, I had this romantic idea of Paris from Belle Epoque. So I was terribly disappointed with Paris. I expected it to look differently and to feel differently. And I was so discombobulated by, you know, modern everyday Paris with the Paris of, you know, old sepia photographs and fashion from 100 years before. So I was I like the word in Spanish, decepcionada. It sounds so great. I was deceived. It wasn't Colette's Paris, and
yeah,
I was
no, it wasn't. So, being in Mexico now, what is the community like in Mexico? What is the literary community like there?
Oh, there's a lot of happening, but I try to remove myself from it and come out very, very seldom, because I don't want to get swept up to my previous life of being an arts administrator. I worked with Penn San Miguel for a while, for a couple of years. I'm still a member, and it brought them, helped to bring speakers to help raise funds for our, you know, rescue of emergency fund for writers. But, you know, even that made me feel like I was not focusing on my writing. So, you know, there's a vibrant community here, some real writers and some wannabe writers and people in different, you know, stages of their writing. And that's how it should be. But I try not to be accessible, because otherwise I'm my own worst enemy.
I bring that up only because one of the things that I associate with you so clearly is how generous you are with other writers and putting.
Yeah, it's my blessing and curse.
Yeah, no, I'm sure it is. But, you know, I'm always interested in who you're reading, who you're discovering. Is there anyone that comes to mind that you want to talk about a little bit?
There's a new writer new to me, who just came out with a book called Gordo. And I think it's Jaime Cortez. You know, check that before you. He's got a great book that is sad and tragic and hilarious and funny about a child of migrant workers in California. And I think that's a great book. I'm always going to champion Christine Granados from El Paso. She's a fiction writer who's been overlooked, and I can't tell you, you know, how much I admire her writing. And let me see who else. There's a young man in San Antonio, Joe Jimenez, fiction. He's writing a new novel. He's a poet and a fiction writer. I think he's terrific. There's a lot of younger writers coming up from Texas that I'm familiar with that are gay writers, and they're all so great, you know, especially, but the problem is a lot of them write poetry, so they never have that crossover appeal, because people aren't used to reading poetry. So I don't know, there's just so many. I list about a lot of them in the by the book section last Sunday, New York Times.
Yeah, no, it was really wonderful. And the other thing that I really love too is your discussion of immigrant children and your, you know, incredible devotion to sort of highlighting that, and also highlighting some of the people like Ruth Behar who write about that. And that's
René Calato Lainez, who writes children books, because he was an immigrant child. Reina Grande, of course. I'm reading The Galleys to Manuel Munoz's book that also has beautiful short stories about people who are working and migrating. And another wonderful writer, you know, Manuel Munoz, my colleague. So there's a lot of good stuff coming
it's
up.
It's a right wonderful now. Time, don't you think?
Yes, it's like a renaissance. And you know, when I get anthologies now, Mitch, I'm delighted that I don't know most of the younger writers, that there's so many new ones. I'm so excited by the flourishing that's happening. And if I don't know them, that's great. That means there's new writers coming up, a crop.
And I think this is a good time to mention somebody that we both are so fond of. She's been your agent for so long. And that's someone who basically was a pioneer in helping to bring so many new voices out. And that's Susan.
Susan Burkholz has changed literary history. I think when someone does their thesis one day in the future, she's this unsung behind the scenes hero that helped to get me published and, you know, really worked really hard to get so many writers of color published in New York.
Do you mind? I don't want to spring this on you. Can you read a little bit from the book, do you think? We would love that if you could. I know you have another interview coming up as well. Yeah. So,
okay. Sometimes I think of you at moments, Marta, when I'm teaching the youngest how to brush her own hair or pinning my toes on the back porch and painting my girl's toes too. I suspect it must be that way for you too. which is when we both must be thinking of the other, tugging and yanking like tides. To lose myself in a book, Martita. In 88 BC, Mithridates, king of Pontus on the Euxine, was at war with Rome. Isn't that pretty? Did you know the Euxine was what they called the Black Sea back then? To live in a book for a little, a story, a poem. Wonder how it is a poem can say so much, so beautifully.
Ah, so beautiful, Sandra. Thank you so much for being on The Literary Life.
Thank you. Thank you for the great conversation. We got started before we knew we were getting started, and I thank you.